Raleigh Tobacco was fully aware of the white man's smug self-satisfaction, although no sign of it showed on his face. There had been that flat spot in the Cuban's otherwise clear green gaze. Only someone with Raleigh's developed powers of observation would have noticed that. Raleigh had worked with these whites from Russia and Cuba for many years now, and he had come to understand that in dealing with them, only one principle was fixed and certain. They were never to be trusted, not in any circumstances or even in the smallest detail. He had learnt to fake his acceptance, to give them false signals of compliance, such as the deliberate physical relaxation and the frank, trusting smile. However, he never forgot for one instant that they were white. Like most Africans, Raleigh was a natural racist and a tribalist. He hated these white men who patronized and condescended to him across the conference table with the same passion as he hated the white policemen who had fired the bullets at Sharpeville. He had never forgotten for a single waking minute that dreadful day when under a blue African sky he had held in his arms the girl he loved, the lovely black maiden who was to have been his wife. He had held her and watched her die, and then before her flesh cooled, he had thrust his fingers deep into the bullet wounds in her chest and made his vow of vengeance. The vow had been made not only against the assassins, but against them all, every white face and every bloody white hand that had forced slavery and subjugation upon his tribe down the centuries. Hatred was the fuel on which Raleigh Tobacco's life ran. He watched the white faces across the table, and smiled and drew strength and resolve from his hatred. "So," he said, "you will take care of the woman. It is agreed. Now let us move on."
A moment." Ramon lifted his hand to restrain him, and turned back to Joe Cicero. "If I am to proceed with Red Rose, then there is the matter of the budget for the operation."
"We have already allocated 2,000 British sterling," General Cicero protested.
"Just sufficient for the preliminary stage. The budget will have to be upgraded. Red Rose is the daughter of a wealthy capitalist, and to impress her I will have to maintain my role as a Spanish grandee." They argued for a few minutes more, while Raleigh Tobacco tapped his pencil impatiently on the tabletop. The African division was the Cinderella of the Fourth Directorate, and every ruble had to be counted. It was degrading, Raleigh thought as he listened to them haggle. They were more like a pair of old women selling pumpkins beside a dusty African road than two men planning the overthrow of an evil empire and the liberation of 15 million oppressed black souls. At last they agreed, and Raleigh found it difficult to conceal his disgust as he repeated, "Can we move on to discuss my itinerary for the African tour?" He had believed that this was the reason for today's meeting. "Has the authorization been received from Moscow?" The discussions went on into the afternoon. They ate a frugal lunch set up from the consulate canteen as they worked, and the fog of Joe Cicero's cigarette smoke dulled the shaft of sunlight through the single high window. The room was a high-security unit on the top floor, regularly swept for electronic listening devices and safe from outside surveillance. At last Joe Cicero closed the file in front of him and looked up. His dark eyes were bloodshot from the smoke and the strain.
"I think that covers all points for discussion, unless there's anything new."
They shook their heads.
"As usual, Comrade Machado will leave first," said Joe Cicero. It was an elementary rule of procedure that they should never be seen in public in each other's company. Ramon left the consulate by the entrance to the visa section, the busiest part of the building, where he would be less noticeable in the crowd of students and others applying for travel documents to the Soviet Union. There was a bus stop directly outside the walled consulate. He took a number 88 bus, but left it at the next stop and hurried through the Lancaster Gate entrance to Kensington Gardens. He lingered in the Rose Garden until he was certain he was not being followed, and then crossed the park. His flat was in a narrow side street off Kensington High Street. It had been rented specifically for the Red Rose operation, and although it contained only a single bedroom, the living room was spacious and the locality was fashionable. During the 2 weeks that he had been in residence, Ramon had managed to create an air of permanence. His personal chests had come from Cuba in the diplomatic bag. They had contained the few good pictures his father had left him, and other small items of furnishing, including family photographs in silver frames of his parents and the family castles and estates in Andalusia, when these had been in their heyday. The glassware and porcelain were incomplete sets, but they bore the Machado coat of arms, the stag and the boar rampant on either side of the quartered shield. His golf clubs were displayed casually in the corner of the tiny entrance hall, the plain leather Hermes bag well used, the discreetly embossed coat of arms almost obscured by wear. From what he had learnt about Red Rose, he knew that she would have an eye for such detail. He glanced at the venerable gold Cartier, another family heirloom, that felt unfamiliar on his wrist. He would have to hurry. His growth of beard was heavy and dark. He shaved it off quickly but carefully, and then showered and washed the stink of Joe Cicero's Turkish cigarettes out of his hair. He checked himself automatically in the mirror as he went through to the bedroom. He had been in peak physical condition when he had returned from Russia 3 weeks previously. The refresher course for senior officers at the KGB training college on the shores of the Black Sea had honed his body, and although he had managed to take little physical exercise since then, the lack was not yet apparent. His body was still sleek and hard, his belly flat and his body hair crisp and curly black. The scrutiny he directed at his image was completely without vanity. Face and body were simply implements, tools to be used to accomplish the tasks that he was set. He had no illusions about the fleeting nature of his physical attributes, but he worked to prolong it in the same way that a warrior cared for his weapons. Gym tomorrow, he promised himself. Ramon had the use of a martial arts studio in Bloomsbury, run by a Hungarian refugee. 2 hours of hard work a couple of times a week would maintain him in fit condition for the Red Rose operation. His riding breeches were cavalry whipcord, and he wore a sage-coloured Treviera woolen shirt with a green tie under his tweed hacking jacket. His riding boots fitted him like a second skin, with a supple gloss of dubbined leather that flexed into perfect creases over his ankles as he moved. No amount of craftsmanship or money, only years of loving attention could achieve that effect. He knew that Red Rose was a horsewoman. In her world, horses were a major part of existence. She would recognize those boots as a badge of membership of the same exclusive and elite group to which she belonged. He checked his watch again. He had timed it nicely. He locked the flat and went down into the street. The rain clouds that had threatened earlier in the afternoon had dispersed, and it had turned into a glorious summer evening. Even the elements seemed to conspire to assist him. The riding stables were in a narrow mews behind the guard's barracks. The stable manager recognized him. As Ramon signed the register, he ran his eye down the immediately preceding entries and saw that his good fortune was persisting. Red Rose had signed for her mount 20 minutes previously. He went down to the stalls, and the groom had the saddle on his mount. She was a bay filly that Ramon had chosen with care, and for which he had paid £500 from his expense budget. However, she had been a bargain, and he knew that he would recoup the cost and probably make some profit whenever he chose to sell her on. He checked the girth and harness, speaking softly to the filly, soothing her with hands and voice, and then thanked the groom with a nod and went up into the saddle. On an evening like this, there were 50 or so other riders in Rotten Row. Ramon walked the filly under the oaks, while groups of horsemen cantered past him in both directions. The girl was not amongst them. As soon as she had warmed a little, he pressed the filly with his toes, and she moved up into a trot. She had an elegant action, and he rode her like a centre, his superior horsemanship obvious even in that expert company. They made a striking pair, and more than a few of the women they passed turned in the saddle to look back after them. At the Park Lane end of the row, Ramon turned and moved the filly up into an easy canter. Galloping was forbidden. 100 yards ahead, a group of 4 riders were coming towards him. 2 couples, young people, well mounted and turned out, but the girl stood out amongst them like a sunbird in a flock of sparrows. From under her riding hat, her hair undulated like the wing of a bird in flight, and glistened in the buttery sunshine. When she laughed, her teeth were very white, and her colour was vivid from the exercise and the wind in her face. Ramon recognised the man riding beside her. He had been her companion on most occasions that he had observed Red Rose over the previous 2 weeks. Ramon had requested information on him from records. He was the second son of an extremely wealthy family of brewers, an effete upper-class playboy of the type known in London society as a Deb's Delight, or Hooray Henry. And he had been with her at the Rolling Stones concert 4 days ago. Since then, Red Rose had spent 2 evenings in his company, party-hopping around Knightsbridge and Chelsea. Ramon had noticed that she treated him with a type of amused condescension, as though he were an over-affectionate St. Bernard puppy, and that on no occasion that he had followed them had she been alone in his company, except when he drove her in his MG from one party to the next. Ramon was almost certain that they were not sleeping with each other, which was unusual in this summer of 1969, when sexual license was a raging epidemic. He also knew that Isabella Courtney was not a simpering virgin. In the 3 years that she had been living at Highfield, it was documented that she had indulged in at least 3 explosive, if short-lived, liaisons. As the gap between them closed, Ramon transferred his attention to the horse under him and leant forward to pat her neck. "There, my darling, there," he spoke to her in Spanish, while from the corner of his eye he was watching the girl. It was a trick that he had of deflecting his gaze, so that he seemed not to be looking, while he missed not the smallest detail. They were almost past each other, when he saw the girl's chin snap up and her eyes fly wide open. But he ignored her and rode on. "Ramon!" her cry was high and imperative. "Wait!" He checked the filly and glanced back with a little frown of annoyance. She had wheeled her own mount and was riding after him, and he let his expression remain reserved and slightly frosty, as though he resented her scraping acquaintance. She drew up beside him, reining her horse down to a walk. "Don't you remember me? It's Isabella Courtney. You were my saviour." Her smile was uncertain and awkward. Men always recognised her, no matter how fleeting or distant their last meeting. "At the concert in the park," she ended lamely. "Ah!" Ramon allowed his smile to bloom at last. "The motorcycle mascot. Forgive me. You were dressed rather differently then." "You didn't wait for me to thank you," she accused him. She suppressed the urge to laugh out loud with relief that he had recognised her at last. "Oh, no thanks were necessary. Besides which, you had a rather urgent business elsewhere, as I recall." "Are you on your own?" she changed the subject quickly. "Why don't you join us? Let me introduce you to my friends." "Oh, no, I don't want to impose myself." "Please," she insisted. "You'll enjoy them. They're good fun." And Ramon bowed slightly in the saddle. "How can I refuse such a kind invitation from such a lovely lady?" he agreed. And Isabella felt as though her chest was in a vice. She had difficulty breathing as she looked into those green eyes in the face of a dark angel. The other 3 had reined in and were waiting for them. Even before she came up to him, she saw that Roger was already sulking, and it gave her a vindictive little pleasure to say, "Roger, may I introduce the Marquis de Santiago y Machado? Ramon, this is Roger Coates Granger." She noticed Ramon glance at her quizzically, and only then realised that she had made a gaffe by using his title. He had not mentioned it at their first meeting. However, her momentary discomfort was forgotten when she introduced Ramon to Harriet Beecham and saw how Harriet reacted to him. She actually licked her lips like the cat in the television advertisement for pet food. Harriet was Isabella's best friend in London, more out of symbiotic consideration than out of genuine mutual affection. Lady Harriet was Isabella's entrance ticket to the inner circles of London society. As the daughter of a belted earl, she was welcome where Isabella, despite her looks and family wealth, would have been considered a nouveau riche interloper with a funny accent. Harriet, on the other hand, had found that wherever Isabella Courtney was, there swiftly assembled a superabundance of males. Beneath Harriet's plump, bland, and colourless blonde exterior flourished a ravenously amorous nature, and Isabella was happy to pass on her rejects to her.